rejected or feeling, it's the pain of powerlessness.
It is. It is. And you can go right down to the very root of the pain of powerlessness.
And that is?
Feeling unlovable. Mm. Feeling as though you want to belong and you don't belong. Mm-hmm. Feeling as though...
You're not worthy.
You're not worthy. Mm-hmm. Feeling as though you want to love, but you can't love.
So when you peel back the layers of all those things, that's where you get to.
You get to...
That's what the anger is about, the depression is about, all those negative
emotions.
That's
the pain of powerlessness, and there's more. It's the feeling that you're intrinsically flawed, mm-hmm. that you're fundamentally defective. Mm-hmm. That if people could see you the way you really are, they wouldn't want to have anything to do with you. That's the pain of powerlessness, and everybody has it, everybody who's human. Now, for millennia, we have addressed the pain of powerlessness just as we've been talking about, by reaching outward to change the physical world. Mm-hmm. You get a trophy husband, a trophy wife. You get a mountain bike that's better than anyone else's. Mm-hmm. Your dreadlocks are cooler than anyone mm-hmm. else's in the world. Your sandals are the best.
That our culture does, I think, more so than anybody else's, right? This Western culture is geared toward, I am better because I have this. My stuff is better than your stuff.
Here I'd like you to consider that in the West we have certainly defined characteristics that make that obvious, but I'm talking about human experience.
I gotcha.
Human experience. So these parts of your personality that come from fear, always in the past, you can still mask them temporarily by striving to change people around you. That's the pursuit of external power, by the way, the ability to manipulate and to control.
Yeah.
Now, here's the thing. Choice of intention is the fundamental creative act. I ask everyone to consider that they are powerful and creative, compassionate and loving spirits.
And that you are co-creating your life whether you recognize it or not.
Exactly.
It is happening.
Exactly. You are co-creating your life with the universe, and your part
is
the choice of intention.
Yes.
So that when you become an aware creator, you do not become a more powerful creator. You become more able to use your creative capacity in a loving way. So when you're not aware of what your intention is, for example, in that moment when someone gets angry or jealous, in that moment when someone goes to the refrigerator and eats a quart of chocolate chip ice cream they don't need, when you're not aware of your intention, you're creating with fear. You're a powerful creator. When you are aware of your intention, mm-hmm. then you can choose mm-hmm. whether you want to create with an energy of fear, with an intention of fear, or with an intention of love.
I think the most important thing to understand is the principle, number one, of cause and effect.
Yes.
That for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And I've been drilling that into my girls since they were in the seventh grade, that every action is going to have a consequence. There's going to be equal opposite reaction, and that intention is what is going to rule that cause and determine the effect.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Here, let me use this example. Whatever you throw up above you comes down. Mm-hmm. Let's suppose that what you throw upward is a rock. It's going to go upward. And then gravity begins to affect it, and it slows, and it slows, and it slows, and then it reaches its apogee, and then it reverses direction, and it starts back down, and gravity accelerates its motion until it comes right back down with the same force that it was thrown upward. That's what happens to you, no matter what you throw upward. If you throw a feather pillow up into the air, mm-hmm. same thing happens, but when it comes down, it feels sort of cool.
Yeah.
So once you understand that, you become more thoughtful about what you throw into the air. Every intention, you are throwing something into the universe, and it will find you. And this is the universal law of cause and effect. In the East, it's called karma. Mm-hmm. Here we call it the golden rule. It is to allow us to learn through our own experiences how powerful we are as creators and how responsible we are for what we create.
It's like the wonderful line in The Color Purple that I used for a clip of it on my very last show, actually. The line when Mr. is throwing Miss Seeley out of the house, Miss Seeley is leaving the house. Remember that?
Yes.
And Whoopi says, as the character Seeley, everything you try to do to me is already done to you. I remember first coming across that concept in Seed of the Soul, the chapter on karma. You never have to really worry about what happens to somebody who does harm to you or creates an atmosphere of betrayal, as you were saying, because the karmic debt that they will have to pay, it will take care of itself.
That is karma. It, you don't have to take
revenge
on the role of judge and jury.
Yes.
And if you do, it will create
negative
karma for yourself.
So the big question is, how do people apply these principles once you come to understand? First, there's a level of awareness. I remember when I first read Seed of the Soul, I just felt, like I suddenly came alive. Like, oh, there's a whole nother part of myself I didn't even know existed. So you come alive, but how do you then begin to actively apply the principles?
This is what gives me the most joy. If you can't apply it, why learn it?
Yes, why learn it?
Why even go through it? Suppose, for example, you're a mother and you've got three children and you're in overwhelm a lot.
Right.
And one of the children in particular is a bit demanding.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have a husband and he's been working away all day, away from home. He may or may not be sympathetic or even appreciative of how much work it is to be at home with three children and to prepare for him coming home. So you can find yourself overwhelmed. You can find yourself frustrated or exasperated by the child that's most demanding. You can find yourself angry at your husband. What do you do? This is exactly the time that you have the opportunity to create authentic power. And here's how you do it. First of all, instead of acting, whatever the impulse is, to tell the child, Tommy, be quiet, or you're going to go to your room for 6 months,
mm-hmm.
or telling your husband, whatever you tell him.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, go inside.
Go inside.
Go inside. That's the first step. That is developing emotional awareness. The second step, and once you can do this, you put yourself in a very powerful position. Because just by turning inward instead of acting in the moment, you have created a little gap
mm-hmm.
between the impulse and the action.
Mm-hmm.
And into that space, you can inject consciousness. Into that space, you can do something you couldn't have done before. Choose
mm-hmm.
consciously.
Yeah.
You can decide, I am going to say this to my husband. He's insensitive and I'm sick and tired of him being sensitive.
Or I'm not.
Or I'm going instead to act from the most loving part of my personality that I can reach for in that moment.
I hear.
And it may be that the most loving part of your personality you can reach for is just not to say anything.
Mm.
But you have then changed your universe.
Yes.
It's your choice. And you make the choice every time you choose an intention. When you choose an intention of love, instead of an intention of fear.
And that is the spiritual journey.
That is the spiritual journey. That is the spiritual path. You become aware of all of the parts of your personality
mm-hmm.
that do not want to act in love. And you don't act on them.
Mm-hmm.
It's that simple. I mean, it's simple, but it's
difficult.
Challenging.
It's
difficult.
Challenging.
This is
because
the
it's
path.
Easier just, you know what it is? I know, and you use the term conscious by meaning being awakened and aware to what is going on. And it's just really easier to be in denial and not to be awakened. It's just easier.
In my experience, it's very painful to be aware of the sensations that are behind the impulse to shout,
yeah.
the impulse to be right, to
yeah.
win a power struggle.
That's right.
But as painful as they are, I've come to see that it's not as painful as the consequences that I have created
yeah.
with my anger and with my determination to win every power.
When
struggle.
I say it's easier to be in denial, it's certainly easier to be unaware. But to be unaware is to live a deadened life.
Yes.
It's to live a deadened life.
And painful life.
And a painful life is to see people. And it's so interesting because to see people walking around struggling all of the time, it's very painful. People who are not aware that they don't have to suffer.
That's right. And here's a central thing in it, is understanding that when you feel emotional pain.
Yes.
at first it seems as though something or someone else caused that pain.
Yes.
But as you develop emotional awareness, you'll discover that your pain was not caused by someone else. Someone else triggered a dynamic in you that is painful to experience.
Mm.
And when you divert your attention to changing the trigger, you may or may not gain some satisfaction. The more the loving parts of your personality are the ones you're cultivating, the more opportunity you have.
Absolutely.
The more fear is controlling you, the more contracted and the more limitation you have. And the more you cultivate a loving part of your personality, the more it begins to fill your experience and your field of awareness until that's all that is. So creating authentic power is a process. It's not an event. It's done decision by decision, step by step, choice by choice. The point is to contribute what you can to life, because that's the nature of love. And love doesn't require that it be acknowledged, doesn't require that it even be effective. When the sun shines on you, it doesn't say, how'd I do today? Are you appreciating me yet? I can do better tomorrow.
Yeah.
It just shines. And that's where the joy in life comes from. And to create that place is our evolutionary requirement now. That's creating authentic power. That's what requires becoming aware of every part of our personality and not acting on those that control us compulsively, unconsciously, and acting on those that we know are aligned with our soul.
Well, that is the essence of the seat of the soul.
That is the seat of the soul. That's why the choice of intention is the fundamental creative act. The choice of intention is the choice that brings energy into form. That creates matter. That creates consequences.
I knew it was the most important one. I knew it.
Yes.
Thanks, Gary Zukav. Thanks.
Chapter 3. Mindfulness. My goal is to live my life as a more awakened, vibrant, alive human being. My prayer is to not let any moment pass without my acknowledgement and full experience of it. In order to do that, I've got to practice. There are so many simple pleasures that allow me to delight in the present moment. A long walk in solitude or a spirited hike with friends brings a renewed sense of gratitude and connection. I consider reading a book a sacred indulgence. And I also happen to love a cup of piping hot masala tea. The daily ritual of being at the sink, boiling the water, steaming the milk, and then steeping the tea helps bring me to a place of stillness. Whether it's watching a sunset or really feeling the stream of water hit your face in the shower, everyone needs to take time to find a way to quiet themselves. Allowing these moments of awareness and recognizing that it is a magnificent thing to be alive, regardless of what might be pressing on me, has brought a level of calm that words cannot adequately explain. Many of the spiritual teachers who have talked with me on Super Soul Sunday described the highest state of mindfulness as a constant state of prayer. This means acknowledging only what you are experiencing in that moment. The true power of staying in the now means that you resist projecting what might happen in the future or lamenting past mistakes. There will always be times of stress or sadness, but when you feel the earth moving, that's the time to bring yourself back to center. Whatever shakeup or disturbance that might come, you'll handle that when it actually happens. But in this moment, you're still breathing. In this moment, you've survived. In this moment, you're finding a way to step onto higher ground. Today and every day, I continue to do the consciousness work, focusing on prayer and just being still. I awaken, and my first thought is, thank you. And my next thought is, I'm still here in this body. I feel the all, with a capital A, that is God, so deeply that it lifts and carries me. Sometimes I actually feel weightless in the love that I call God, because I sense it in all things. The entry point for living consciously is mindfulness. Let these words and examples be your guide to becoming more relaxed, responding to the inevitable swirl around you with compassion. Staying present is the reason, after talking to thousands of people over the years, I still have aha moments. Meaningful things happen when you release the anxious thoughts and negative chatter that's in your head and tune in to what the person in front of you is saying. Slowing down, showing up, and listening to your child, your spouse, parent, or friend shows them that they have been seen and heard by you. Not only are you providing validation when they need it most, you are consciously creating your own spiritual practice. My conversation with author, scientist, and mindfulness expert Jon Kabat-Zinn, which you're about to hear, brings home the message that without mindfulness, you may be missing out on the most beautiful aspects of your life. As Jon Kabat-Zinn says, the perfect moment is this one.
It's so fascinating to me that when we first met in 1992, the word mindful was actually cutting edge. People were like, what are you talking about? They didn't even know what we were talking about. And now it's sort of become the buzzword for the time. I mean, a lot of people use it in terms of their daily practice, their classes about it, their schools where they're teaching mindfulness to children, all because of you. So mindfulness for beginners, in it you say, I see mindfulness as a love affair with life. Wow, what a powerful sentence. With reality and imagination. I see mindfulness as a love affair with life, with reality and imagination, with the beauty of your own being, with your heart and body and mind and with the world. Now, that sounds like a lot to take in, which it is, and that is why it can be so valuable to experiment systematically with cultivating mindfulness in your life. So what does it mean for us to cultivate mindfulness?
It's actually very simple.
It's the simplest thing we could ever do, isn't it?
It's totally simple, but it's not so easy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the beauties of it, is that having worked now in the medical field for over 35 years, we're seeing that even though it's not easy, thousands and tens of thousands of people are willing to roll up their sleeves and actually cultivate it. So what mindfulness is a particular way of being in relationship to your life. And the place to start, of course, is the fact that we're only alive in this moment. The future hasn't happened yet. The past is memory and is over. But if you start to pay attention to where your mind is, most of the time it's not in the present moment. It's off someplace else, obsessing about the past or planning or worrying about the future. So what mindfulness is a particular way of paying attention and the awareness that arises from paying attention in that way. And that way is on purpose, in the present moment, non-judgmentally.
So is it the same thing as meditation?
It is a form of meditation.
Okay, because it's an easier entry.
Glide path.
I like glide path. It's an easier glide path, I think, for people to accept, I want to be more mindful than I want to meditate. Because whenever we've done shows with Deepak and others about meditation, people are like, I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it right. When in fact, whatever is happening is what's supposed to be happening.
Exactly.
Right?
This is the biggest problem.
People think something's supposed to happen.
Yeah, and I know it's not happening because I'm just sitting here miserable and bored and the breath is so stupid, and why do I have to pay attention to that? Or my mind is so inflamed. And they think, oh, if I were really meditating, my mind would be a blank, my breath would be easy, I'd feel so wonderful. So the easiest thing for people to think about mindfulness is that it equals awareness. you and I sitting here having a conversation, you know, the thought might cross one of our minds, well, when are we going to get down to meditating? The fact is we are. And then your life, in some sense, becomes the meditation practice. You see, rather than something I have to do.
Do for 20 minutes.
20 minutes or whatever.
You're always doing it.
If you are awake, if you are willing to be in your body, if you are willing to be in this moment, to whatever degree you can manage. Because a lot of the time, we got a lot of things going at the same time.
Yeah. I just had a conversation with Michael Pollan, who wrote a book called Cooked. And he was saying, when you're in the kitchen cooking, if you're stirring the pot, just stir the pot.
It's like, you think you understand what it means, but it has infinite depth
yes.
to it. So when you're stirring the pot, just stir the pot. So what does that mean? It's powerful. The more you let that run inside you, the more it actually transforms your understanding of who you are.
Wow.
It's very deep.
Very deep. So to be mindful means to be, there's no difference between being mindful and then being fully in this moment now.
With awareness.
With
yes.
awareness.
Yes.
So it's not just being, it's having this conversation, but also being
knowing that we're having the conversation.
Yeah.
Because conversations are complicated. Every moment is complicated in the sense that in the next moment, you could bring something up. I would respond one way. If you brought something else up, I might respond another way. I could interrupt you, mm-hmm. be impolite. I mean, there are a million different ways in which this could unfold. But since you're holding it and I'm holding it, there's a certain way in which we're both holding a space
mm-hmm.
that allows something to emerge that might not emerge otherwise.
And if people were having trouble understanding it, look at how many conversations people have with their kids where they're not even really, or anybody, and you're just sort of playing
really
lip
present.
Service. Yeah, you're not being fully present.
Not only that.
And your kids can feel
the, know it.
And they know
exactly.
it. That's it. Your kids, more so than anybody, can feel when you are feeling them, when you have the awareness
they
of
know
them.
When you're present.
Yeah, when you're
and
being,
there's
when they're
no
being,
greater
and when they're
gift.
Being, yeah.
There's no greater gift you can give your children than to be present for them.
You say there are so many misconceptions about what meditation really is. This is from the introduction to Wherever You Go, There You Are. You say, when we speak of meditation, it's important for you to know that this is not some weird cryptic activity, as our popular culture might have it. It does not involve becoming some kind of zombie vegetable, self-absorbed narcissist, navel gazer, or space cadet. Meditation is simply about being yourself and knowing something about who that mm-hmm. is. Wow, that's so powerful. It's about being yourself and knowing something about who
yeah.
that is.
And the irony is, of course, you already are yourself. If you
yes.
could get out of your own way, you could be yourself 24/7.
Yes.
So in a sense, what this meditation practice is about is kind of continually noticing how much we get in our own way through our thinking, through our emotions.
Why is it then so hard for everybody? If it's that simple, it's just about getting out of your own way. Why does everybody make it so hard?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question. I think mm-hmm. that, you know, it may be that it didn't used to be that hard when we were living as hunters and gatherers. You had to be mindful or mm-hmm. you'd get eaten.
Mm-hmm.
When we would sit around fires at the end of the day as hunters and gatherers for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years, once we discovered fire, well, there was no electric lights. I mean, the only thing that was happening was the fire. And you sit around with a group of people and you stare into the embers. That's mindfulness.
And you say, actually, in this book, that it is the direct opposite of taking life for granted.
Yeah, it's the direct opposite of taking. I still agree with what I wrote there.
You were so 25 brilliant.
25 years ago.
You were so brilliant. So when we were having this conversation back in the 90s, I mean, that was before the internet, that was before social media, that was before all the stuff. Is it harder to be less distracted now?
If there is a distractibility index or a self-distraction index, it's going through the roof due to the increasing acceleration of everything. With
we
the
have
internet,
to do.
With, yeah, and also with the internet and social media and everything coming at us digitally.
How do we balance the doing with the being?
Yeah. Well, mindfulness is all about being. And the cliche goes, we're called human beings, but we actually have lost touch with that element of life. That's what we were doing, sitting around fires as hunters and gatherers.
Mm-hmm,
we were
mm-hmm.
being. But now it's gotten so much more complex. What mindfulness is saying is find your own way. Listen to your own heart. Listen to your own, use the word longing.
Longing.
Listen to your own yearning. Because what we're really trying to do is live our life as if it really mattered.
Because it does.
It does. And I like to say, more than you think, and then more than you can think. Because thinking only takes us so far. And it's kind of gotten more PR than other aspects of our being, like awareness itself, and also embodied wakefulness. You know, that the body gets left out of the equation, and we're pretty much up here a lot of the time. And even education is like pouring stuff into here as facts, but where there's no wisdom associated with it. There's no understanding, there's no wisdom.
I think that's going to change.
It is changing.
I think it is changing. And the reason I think it has to change is because I can see the world getting crazier, busier, your life becoming more and more compounded by stuff and outside forces. Mm-hmm. The only way to survive that is through a sense of mindfulness.
I think so, yeah.
It's interesting. When people have a difficult time understanding it, I think your shower example is the best.
Yeah. You remember that?
Yeah. Mm.
I like to say to people, okay, here's a little homework for you after we've talked about mindfulness. And it's very important to keep in mind that mindfulness is not a concept. It's a practice. You have to actually exercise a certain kind of muscle. So I say, here's a little mindfulness homework for you. The next time you're in the shower, check and see if you're in the shower. Because you may not be in the shower. Or you may have your whole Monday morning, 9 o'clock meeting in the shower with you. But you're not actually there under the water, feeling the water on your skin. You're off in the future or off in the past. So that's exercising the muscle. The more you do that, the more you realize, when I'm in the shower, I'm in the shower. When I'm brushing my teeth, I'm brushing my teeth. When I'm saying goodbye to my family, I'm saying goodbye to my family. It only takes a fraction of a second longer to do it with awareness.
Okay, so everybody who's watching this right now, the next time you get in the shower, you're going to think, am I in the shower? Or are you in the meeting? Or are you already
check.
On the freeway?
Yeah.
Check.
And as soon as you check, you're back. And you have something you can do about it. If you are obsessed with some kind of thing, worried about how things are going to go that day or whatever, that's all fine. Your awareness is big enough to hold it all. It's not like now you have to suppress all that thinking or the meeting in the shower. The knowing it is good enough. That knowing is what we call awareness. And then it's laughable, so you'll feel better because you have a sense of humor.
I have some of my best ideas in the shower. And I think one of the reasons why, why so many great ideas come in the shower? Somebody said it's because of the warm water on the back of your neck. But I think it's also because when you're fully just in that moment, there creates an opening or a clearing for other things to come through.
And that's intimately associated with mindfulness, that creativity and imagination. When we get quiet, when we get still, when we rest, you could say, in awareness, our natural impulse to see connections that we didn't see the moment before is unimpeded. And we can actually make these connections and realize them in ways that we might not have been able to do the moment before.
So being in the shower, when you're really in the shower,
That's
a meditation practice.
Yes. And a beautiful one. And guess what? Doesn't take any more time.
Doesn't take any more time to actually be in the shower.
No.
Absolutely.
It's not like I'm saying, take a half hour shower. No. Be aware of how much water we're wasting too. I mean, that's part of the awareness field as well.
Tell us how you came to know what you know. I knew you grew up in a home where art and science were aligned side by side. How did that shape you?
Well, first of all, I was born in New York City in 1944. And my father was what would be called now a molecular immunologist. He was incredibly happy doing that. And my mother was a painter who was very prolific and just continued to paint her entire life. She's over 100 years old now, and she's still redoing her sketches in her hundreds of sketchbooks.
Wow.
And that's her meditation, I realized long afterwards. And my father's meditation was, in some sense, his love of science, and in particular immunology, and how...
And that was his meditation.
Exactly. And as a child, I began to see that these two different ways of knowing the world through the eye of an artist and the world through the eye of a scientist, they actually didn't share their worlds that much. My father didn't love to go to museums, although we did, but he was like tone deaf for both music and for paintings. And my mother couldn't understand the complexity of his, you know, molecular, you know, sort of stuff. But as a child, I saw that there's got to be a way that we can have it all. And so I was always looking for that, and I was on the path to becoming a scientist, but at the same time, I was really interested in languages and things like that, and poetry and music. And when I first got exposed to meditation, I realized this is what I've been looking for, and it's a love affair. I can't put it any other way, because science is really a love affair with reality, and art is also a love affair with reality. And they're just the reality.
And mindfulness is a love affair with life.
Exactly.
Wow. So is mindfulness science? Is it art? Is it spiritual?
It's a gateway into the full dimensionality of being human.
Oh,
being alive.
I love that. It's a gateway into the full dimensionality of being human. And without it, you're just missing out.
Well, you're missing a lot. You know, if you miss the look in your child's eye one day, you've missed it. If you've missed the look in your lover's eyes the next day, you've missed that. If you miss the beauty of sitting under trees, well, you've missed that. If you sum that over many moments, many years, you may wind up missing the most beautiful aspects of your own life. Mm-hmm. Who are you going to blame for that? Well, I was too busy. Well, who is too busy? Who tells oneself, I don't have any time? When all you've got is time, all you've got is this moment, and we might as well take it while we're alive, because sooner or later we're going to be dead. So it's the perfect moment is this one.
Yeah. I think you used the example in the book of trying to, it was one of these books, about trying to put a glass plate over
the ocean.
Over the ocean.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, if you think about the mind, if you start to befriend your mind, which is another way to talk about mindfulness, you start befriending your mind by paying attention to it. You'll notice
it talks too much.
Yeah, it talks a lot.
Oh, my gosh.
So
it never shuts
that's
up.
That's like where the metaphor comes in of the ocean. Okay.
Yeah.
So the ocean, depending on the atmospheric conditions, is always waving.
Yeah.
It's always waving. Sometimes.
Yeah. There are different levels.
Depending on the atmospheric condition, it could be flat like a mirror. At other times, like tsunami, you know, tumultuous. I mean, a hurricane force waves and 100-foot waves and so forth. Perfect storm. But if you drop down 30 or 40 feet in the ocean, even in the midst of these 30 or 40-foot waves, gentle undulation. Same with the mind. Drop underneath your anger, underneath your anxiety, underneath all that. What do you find? You find awareness capable of holding it all and seeing, knowing this is anxiety.
And it's the same awareness that is connected to everything.
And everybody.
And everybody.
Yeah, so
that's where we're all
separate.
The same. We're all the same in our awareness.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And
that's where
compassion arises naturally out of that.
Out of awareness, yeah.
Because the immediate experience is one of interconnectedness, that we share in a larger space where we can't, like, have this conversation. I need you and you need me to have this conversation, and we need the people out there hearing it, or what's the point of us doing this except for our own
fun? I like it.
I do too. But the point is that the interconnectedness invites compassion, invites kindness, because we see that no matter how different we are, we're not that different.
Yeah.
We are mostly totally the same as human beings. Our minds are unruly. We distract ourselves, you know, infinitely. We're like, you know, out of our minds a lot of the time, but we have the capacity to know it and therefore drop back in.
Well, I think that's true. We're out of our mind. No, we're out of our awareness most of the time.
And out of our hearts.
And out of our hearts. I love how you say that the negative thoughts that we often hear are not big enough thoughts. That's a big aha. Explain what you mean by that.
A lot of the time, we think we know who we are. And we have a whole story about who we are.
Yeah.
And what that point is that the story's just not big enough. How much is the story about how beautiful you are? How much is the story about how large your heart is when it's at its most content, happiest? Okay. So we write the story of how miserable I am, how much I need this or that, need more money, need more of this, need more of that, need more health. All of which may be true on a relative level, but it's just not a big enough story. So the story of like your luminosity, your beauty, the fact that there is more right with you than wrong with you, no matter what's wrong with you.
Ooh, I love that.
That doesn't come on the radar screen. But as soon as we bring it back, we remind ourselves. See, that's the meditation practice.
So are we as human beings, are we designed to just judge ourselves by the negative all the time? Because why is it that the negative thoughts have such an impact on us?
A lot of it has to do with our upbringing and our education, that, you know, we are educated in a certain way, but we're not being educated how to be, only how to accomplish. So it's all about acquisition. It's about getting stuff we don't have.
You say it's when we actually believe our thoughts that we spiral into anxiety and depression.
Exactly. And as soon as you see that that depression is caused by what was called in psychology depressive rumination, it's like a particular kind of toxic thought pattern that drills you down deeper and deeper and deeper into a black hole of nothingness.
Yeah.
And as soon as you realize that's a thought pattern, then the you that realizes it isn't part of the pattern. And you can actually...
You can stop it.
You can write yourself a restraining order. Or like a soap bubble, you know, you touch a soap bubble, it goes poof. Thoughts, when you see them in awareness, when you hold them in awareness, it's like touching a soap bubble. It'll just self-liberate. It'll go poof. And it doesn't spiral down into that chain of concatenation of depressive thoughts.
When you realize that you are not your thoughts, but the awareness of your thoughts.
Exactly. Not the thinker, but the awareness.
The awareness.
Beautiful.
Beautiful. What do you think happens when we die?
Oh, I know you've asked a lot of people that question. I'll give you a very short answer.
Okay.
I don't know, and I don't actually think about it. I'm interested in life before death. Is the question, actually, is there life before death? That's the question I'm interested in.
Is there life before death?
Because if you're zoning along on autopilot, you may miss, as we were saying, the most beautiful aspects of your own life. In a certain way, you died
years ago.
Exactly, years ago.
There are a lot of people I see who've been dead for a long time. And nobody's ever said that. Is there life? That's the question you need to be asking yourself. What is your life before death?
Is there life before death?
Is there life before death? Is there life before death? Finish the sentence. I believe.
I don't do well with belief. So I would put it more in terms of I experience.
Okay.
So I experience the beauty of human beings in uncanny ways that allow me to feel a deep optimism about what we are capable of as individuals, as a nation, as a species, and that when push comes to shove, and I hope it just doesn't get too horrible, any more horrible than it is now before it turns, we need to wake up to a much larger understanding of the beauty of being here on this planet together, and if you don't mind me putting it this way, get our shit together as a species.
I like that. For Super Soul, get your shit together. That's pretty good.
And you can do it right in this moment. There's no other moment.
I love it. That's a good way of saying be mindful or get your shit together. That's great. Thank you. That's really good.
Chapter 4, Spiritual GPS. Your life is always speaking to you. The fundamental spiritual question is this: will you listen? The meaning of wisdom for me is recognizing the moment when what you know aligns perfectly with what you feel. That powerful flash of clarity telling you the right decision to make originates from only one source. You, with a capital Y. There is the little you, your personality, and the greater you, spelled with a capital Y, your soul. The people you love and trust most will hopefully always be there to offer advice. But you are on your own journey, responsible for charting your own course. Whenever I felt most tested, lost, or unsure of my own direction, these words from Invictus, which I memorized at 8 years old, have been a way forward. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. With every decision, you are steering your own ship. Beneath all of those protective layers built up between you and the world lives an inner voice that goes by many names. Some call it instinct or intuition. I call that persistent knowing, our spiritual GPS. It acts as our internal compass designed to help you move through life no matter what distractions or obstacles get in your way. Your GPS is always turned on. Whether you're headed on the right track or about to take a destructive turn, your emotional guidance system lets you know. Every right decision I have ever made has come from listening to my gut. Every wrong decision was a result of me dismissing that small, still voice within me. Your life speaks to you in whispers, that little nudge saying, something doesn't feel right. If you ignore it, those whispers turn into pebbles thrown at you, warning, there's a problem, danger ahead. If those signs remain unexamined, you will inevitably experience what feels like a heavy brick to the head. Shutting out the brick guarantees disaster will eventually strike. You will see your life come crashing down like a brick wall. I've seen this happen so often in my own life, I now try to respond immediately at the first whisper. What every one of these Super Soul Sunday conversations has taught me is that no matter who you are, if you've been faking your way through life, ignoring your inner compass, the wake-up call can be harsh. Job loss, the end of a relationship, money problems, disruption in any form, no matter how devastating. These are also opportunities to stop sleepwalking through your life, to wake up and pay attention to the red flags, the whispers, the pebbles, and bricks along the way. Your real purpose on earth is to become more of who you really are, to live to the highest degree what is pure, what is honest, what is natural, what feels like the real you. You'll know you found it when every cell in your body vibrates with your own truth, when you're filled up by what you're doing instead of being drained by it. Follow your instincts. That's where true wisdom unfolds. What I loved about my conversations with Michael Bernard Beckwith is that he clarifies so perfectly the idea that we are all vibrational beings. And if we tune our GPS to the vibration that we want to experience, not only will we align with our true purpose, we will begin to radiate all that we hoped to encounter. Listen while Reverend Beckwith explains why we cannot have what we're not willing to become.
I'm excited. I get an hour of you to myself, not in a pulpit, on a stage, just to probe your mind about how we all can create a life vision for ourselves. But I think about people who have circumstances that aren't as good as mine or yours. Is it possible to life vision when you're at the bottom?
Not only is it possible, that's probably the best time to do it. When circumstances and situations are pressing in upon us, the only way we can overcome them is to go within, to actually begin to ask very empowering questions with the awareness that this universal presence and its law will answer any question that you ask. So if you're in a situation that is pressing on you and you ask, what's trying to emerge in my life? What is my gift to share?
Mm.
What is my purpose? Why am I here on the planet? Not just how can I pay my rent, not just how can I stop the pain, which aren't bad questions.
And not just what should I do?
Not even what should I do.
Not what should I do,
no.
But the universal questions.
You ask empowering questions, the universe will answer these questions in a language and in a way that you can understand. There'll be inner prompting. There'll be intuitive hits, nudges, signs, symbols, dreams. It'll come in the language of the individual soul and heart. The difficulty is that when people are in tough situations, they ask disempowering questions.
Whoa.
They say, what's wrong?
Mm-hmm.
Who's to blame?
Yeah.
Why me?
Yes.
Those are the disempowering questions. So the universe will answer those too. It'll pull on the database of human experience and say, you were born on the wrong side of the tracks, or you were born on the right side of the tracks, or you, this happened or that happened. It'll give you a bevy of excuses. But if you ask an empowering question, you'll get an answer to rise above the muck. So it's all about the question, the sincerity of the question, and then the ability and the willingness to really listen, to really be available. That's where the juice is.
And that is available to every human being.
Whether an individual is in prison, whether an individual is imprisoned by circumstance, imprisoned in their own mind about an event that happened in their past, it doesn't matter. Once you ask with sincerity, the universe will answer. That's the way it operates.
So how do we get, this fascinates me, this conversation, because there have been times, I know in everybody else's experiences, where you think about something or you think about a person and that person calls you.
Right.
Then there are other times where that doesn't happen. I remember one day I manifested tomato soup. I was on my farm and up comes my neighbor with, I couldn't even believe it. So I was like, how did I do that? I want to be able to do that again.
Right.
But it's a space where I wanted it, but if it didn't come, I would also be okay.
That's called the let go.
Yeah. That's what it is.
You know how people do wishing wells? They throw a coin and they forget about it.
Yeah.
And then the thing shows up because they had an intention. Then they let it go. They didn't even think about it anymore.
Right.
And once you release your grasp, then you give up your resistance. And then that which is for you will come to you.
That's the aha moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because when you want it, it doesn't show up.
Yeah. Your message to the universe at that moment is, I want it, which is translating into, I don't have it. So you can't receive it.
So you end up blocking your own blessing.
Totally.
In that way. When did you come to know this? When did your level of connection, spirituality, and alignment reach the space that went beyond religion?
I had left religion at a young age.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was pretty much agnostic going through college. I went to Morehouse College, and I transferred to USC. And so at USC, I had a spiritual awakening. I woke up. I had a lucid dream in which I was killed. When I woke up, I could see tremendous beauty everywhere and the love of God penetrating my being. And I had to go on a search to discover what had happened to me. And so that...
You had a lucid dream?
A lucid dream. I was awake in the dream. Three men came after me. And this dream had been going on a year. I'm just shortening the story here.
Okay.
Culminated with two of the men holding me down. One man stabbed me in the heart. The pain was physically and emotionally intense, excruciating.
This is your dream?
This is my dream, but okay. I could feel it in my physical body.
Okay.
I screamed out. I woke up. The beauty everywhere. I mean, animate and inanimate objects, brilliant, shining.
Mm.
The light everywhere. The love I was feeling from God just penetrating my entire being. It was like, wow.
In the dream?
I had woke up now.
Okay.
Now I'm awake.
You're awake?
I'm awake. And I knew something had happened. So I began to do my research now to discover what had happened to me.
Mm.
And that's when I bumped back into the teachings of Jesus and all the other great teachers who talked about this luminosity, the light that lights up every man and woman that cometh into the world, the true light that was found
in Jesus.
That was
a born-again experience.
Yes, it was totally shifted my whole perception, and I was considered weird.
Mm-hmm.
I was considered, Michael's off his rocker. He's a Jesus freak. What happened to him? Because the guy that went to bed that night was not the same person that woke up.
Yeah.
And my life has been on an unfolding arc of falling more and more and more in love with this presence and being more and more of service. And, you know, we don't want to hypothesize or theorize or philosophize. We want to realize this.
Yeah.
And that's what these teachings do. They help you realize what many people are philosophizing about.
So let's talk about that unfolding. You say that journey comes in four stages of spiritual growth. The first stage is something you call victim consciousness. Can you explain that to me?
Yes. Victim consciousness is where many people live.
Yeah.
Somebody did it to me. The reason why I'm not happy is because you just make, you know, my ex-boyfriend, my boss.
The world isn't fair.
The world isn't fair. They're doing it to me. The reason why I'm not happy is somebody else's fault.
Mm-hmm.
God did it to me. The devil did it to me. My astrological sign did it to me. The numbers did it
to me. My mother.
My karma.
Yeah.
Okay. That's the victim stage. Every victim has a victim story. You ask somebody, a victim, what's going on, and they'll give you a list of complaints about what's wrong and who did it. Fannie Lou Hamer once said, I got sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Yeah, one of my favorite quotes.
So when you get sick and tired of being sick and tired, something happens. And you start to open up to a possibility that maybe I'm in my own way. Maybe there's something more than what meets the eye.
And would you say that if you are stuck and you are sick and tired of being sick and tired, if you're in that space where there's no movement and you've tried everything, that it means you need spiritual momentum or you need an awakening?
Yes.
Yeah.
You need, you're going to need something that is not within your little mind and your little perception.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's where prayer comes in.
Mm-hmm.
That's where meditation comes in. That's where life visioning comes in. So if you just said, help, I'm open, I'm available to something new, now you're on your way.
Yeah. Help is a prayer.
Help is a prayer.
Yeah.
I say, when I use the word help, I say, hello, eternal loving presence. That's what help means to me.
Yeah.
Hello, eternal loving presence. And then things start to come to you. I can remember walking into, back in the day when the Bodhi tree existed, and a book fell off the shelf. I walked in and the book just slammed on the floor off the shelf. And it was exactly what I needed to read at that time. And so I learned about manifestation. I learned about the second stage, which is how to manifest, which is establishing intention, beginning to see visually the kind of life you want to live, beginning to have conversation about that kind of life. I tell people you have to talk about it more than you talk about your problems, because at the end of the day, if you're complaining more than you're talking about your vision, then you're in inertia. So there's a shift that takes place where you're actually talking about the possibilities more than you're talking about your issues.
Yeah.
You don't deny the issues. Bad things have happened to people. You're not denying that those things have happened.
But it's the energy that you give to it. That is a definite true fact. If you start talking about somebody or you're engaged in a conversation where you're gossiping, before long, you're spiraling down.
Energy goes into those lower frequencies.
Yep.
Doubt, worry, fear, and now you're in that sediment.
Mm-hmm.
You're in that dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
But if you start talking about possibility, even if you don't know how to get there, then your energy starts to go up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what if you ask a what if question? You know, what if all my needs were met? What would I be doing in my life? What if everything is really working together for my good? What if all the bad things that have happened in my life are leading me to activating some great potential in my experience?
Mm-hmm.
What if God really is on my side?
Yeah.
You know, you ask a what if question and you start to notice little tiny miracles happening in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Things start to manifest. You don't know how they got there.
Let's talk about vibration. You use it a lot in your teaching. And I noticed, like, everybody at Agape is on a same vibrational frequency and using that language. And I don't know when it was I first got it, that there is an energy and a frequency to everything.
Yes.
And that your whole role and goal in life is to line up with whatever is the frequency that is going to allow you to move in the flow of your own life.
Yes.
How did you discover this?
It's back in the 80s I started using that terminology. Because I became aware that, you know, we are vibrational beings. You know, we're not just flesh and blood. You know, If you put anything under a microscope, an intense microscope, you're going to ultimately see that everything is vibration. And as the scientists are now telling us, there's information there. But it's not solid. It's always moving. So we're vibrational beings. So as you were just saying, when we lift our vibration to what we want to experience, it happens first on a vibratory level. And then it shows up and manifests in our life. So people who are holding on to rancor, animosity, they're slowing down their vibration.
Okay, just had an aha there. You're actually, when you recognize your vibrational frequency, you're drawing into yourself all the time, literally, the vibration that is most like what you're putting out.
Right.
Correct?
Right. Yeah. You cannot, another way of saying is you cannot have what you're not willing to become vibrationally.
Ah.
If you do get it, you'll lose it.
Ah.
You see, this is why people, they'll win the lottery and they lose everything.
Yeah.
Or they'll finally get the person they think they
Absolutely.
Want to be with. They can't keep the relationship, or they'll get a modicum of success but can't hold on to it. Because inside, they weren't vibrationally aligned. They really hadn't become it. So you can temporarily manipulate and get things. But to have it completely, you have to lift your vibration and become that. In vibration.
Oh, that's so good. You need to repeat it. That is so good. Isn't that a... Look, hallelujah, hallelujah. That is so good.
You're not really attracting things to you. You're really radiating. It's really a radiation.
I could cry right now. I felt that so strongly. Yeah. That's going to resonate with a lot of people.
Yeah, you're radiating it from within out. It's like if I become the vibrational frequency of love, harmony, peace... Yeah. And I'm radiating that?
That's the key.
It's going to show up in my life.
That's the key. Yeah. That's the word. You're not attracting it. You have to be it and radiate it, and then it is drawn to you
right.
and you to it. So then the work then becomes about you working on yourself.
Yes.
Yeah.
You have to like yourself when you're by yourself.
Yeah.
You have to like yourself. I mean, when you're by yourself, you have to look at those thoughts. The beautiful thoughts, the crazy thoughts. Mm-hmm. You have to embrace yourself. You have to forgive yourself. You have to love yourself. And when you can fall in love with yourself and like yourself when you're by yourself, now you can be with others. But if you don't like yourself when you're by yourself, then you're pulling on others to make you happy.
Correct.
You see.
You also talk about wealth in the way that, you know, the idea of manifestation can be confusing to people because a lot of people think, you know, I manifested my wealth or I manifested my husband, my possessions. But you say that you limit your true spiritual potential if you get attached to those things.
Right. Those are wonderful signposts along the way. They're yeah. wonderful blessings. But at the bottom line, we're here to unfold our soul.
Bottom line.
Bottom line. We're here to... There's so much good within us.
Yeah. Is that the purpose of human experience, you think?
The purpose of human experience is that we're at a stage of our evolution where we can think about what we think about. We can actually think independent of a circumstance and choose. We can choose and let our soul unfold.
Mm.
And this is very important because either people are in reaction or they're in choice. Choice comes when you expand your awareness. Reaction is if you have limited awareness. So in other words, we both know this. You take of somebody like His Holiness the Dalai Lama or Dr. King,
yeah.
who chose to love
yeah.
in the face of hate. Where many people would react in the face of hate through prayer and meditation, they expanded their awareness and they could choose.
Mm-hmm.
So here in this human dimension, we learn to choose regardless of conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're participating in our own unfoldment. I can actually choose to be better.
So you teach the power of life visioning. What is the difference between visioning and visualization?
This is a great question.
This is good.
Okay. Visualization